Welcome to Comic Book Debate. We're the Faruqi brothers, Shiraz, Zion, Umar, and Samir. And today, we have a special guest. It's none other than Cyborg himself, Ray Fisher. Ray, thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you to the Faruqi bros for having me. I'm a big fan, and I'm excited. I feel grateful. I feel humble. Obviously, we've got Zack Snyder's Justice League out there for the world to see, and it's been a pretty wild ride, but one I'm grateful to be on.
And we're excited to get that, to touch on a lot of that ride throughout this interview. So, Samir, why don't you kick us off with the first question?
So, before we get into Zack Snyder's Justice League and your incredible performance as Cyborg, we want to get to know Ray Fisher. So, what is your origin story, and how did you land the role of Victor Stone?
Well, my origin is pretty simple. I come from a small town called Lawnside, New Jersey. And, I fell in love with acting when I was in high school. I actually had some really inspirational teachers who encouraged me to pursue, right? You know, I was doing musicals in school, and I think very much like most young people growing up, you know, when you're told that, you know, you're good at something, that's something that, you know, you kind of can gravitate toward, and you start going, oh, okay, well, maybe I could see a future in this. Maybe I could see a path forward in this. And so fell in love with acting there and just the sense of community. Ended up going to an acting conservatory in New York City. From there, getting out, pounding the pavement, doing the entire starving artist experience, right? Like riding the subway, hunger pangs, trying to get from one thing to the next, working, you know, a couple different day jobs simultaneously, forming a network with some of my actor friends who I'd gone to school with, some other friends who I'd met along the way. And, you know, just really just grinding, pounding the pavement, for lack of a better term, until fortunately, like these really sort of seemingly random at the time events started happening that like ultimately led to me being able to get an opportunity to audition for Zack Snyder for Batman Superman. And, everything else just kind of fell into place, you know? I've been blessed in a lot of ways that the projects that I've been fortunate to do have been fewer and further between, because it's oftentimes given me, it gives me a lot of time to like get perspective about what I've done and where I'd like to go and what my experience was on the previous thing and how, you know, I see myself moving forward with things. And so it feels like a slow and steady journey more than just like this like overnight sort of like overnight sensation. You know, and it's wild because like, I think a lot of folks don't necessarily see the grind that leads up to the actual, you know, the actual thing evolving. And for me, it was maybe about, I'd say probably like 7-8 years of just like really grinding and pounding the pavement, you know? So I've been doing this now since, I'm 33 now, and I've been doing this since I was 18 years old, like professionally at least, or attempting to do it professionally since I was 18. So it's been about 15 years in the business, and my rap sheet isn't the longest when it comes to the jobs I've done, but I think, you know, the things that I've been able to accomplish in that amount of time have been pretty significant. So I'm humbled by that and grateful.
That's great. I mean, I guess from here, we can jump straight into Zack Snyder's Justice League. So, raw reaction, what did you think about the movie, finally seeing the completed, finished cut, and what was your favorite scene in the film?
Man, I was jumping, I was shouting, I was literally in this room you see me in now. I'm actually down in Mississippi working on a TV show called Women of the Movement, which is going to be a great project that I think the entire world needs to see. But I'm sitting here at this desk watching Zack Snyder's Justice League on my iPad, right, maybe about a week and a half ago. And there were certain points of time where I had to like stand up and walk away from the screen. Like I was literally just like, just bouncing up and down in my chair. I mean, there were moments where I laughed, there were moments where I like cried tears of joy. And it was such a cathartic experience, right? Because of the journey that it took in a lot of ways to get the film out, but also the idea that, you know, all of the struggle was absolutely worth it by what we ended up with in the final product, right? It's not even, it'd be one thing if it was like, hey, listen, you know, you went through all this stuff, you grinded to do this film, and it came out and it was just like, It was all right, right? No, this was like everything all at once, right? It was the grind, it was the struggle, it was the process, it was the collaboration, it was like the feeling of family. I started remembering all the great times that we had on set filming these things, right? And then the movie's awesome on top of that, right? That's just the icing on the cake. And so, I'm still processing. And, you know, one of the early signs for me that we were in good hands was when the movie started, just that Superman sequence at the top, right? That throwback to BVS and how they took that and expanded it into the shout heard around the world, right? Like, just from I mean, people use the word epic a lot when they refer to this movie, and I don't think you can use it enough, really, right? That alone, I'm like, I think this is going to be good. I think we'll be fine. I think we'll be okay. But those were my initial thoughts. I like those sequences that I'm generally more of a fan of the scenes that I'm not in, if that makes any sense. Because, like, you know, as we're filming it, I get to see things sort of like coming to fruition as we're watching playback and like, oh, okay, maybe this, not that, that, not this. But the stuff with Ezra Miller, that was really powerful stuff, you know? And I guess I hadn't even like pieced together how, you know, the Flash and Victor Stone's relationship, the father-son dynamics were like mirrored in certain ways throughout the film until I actually saw it there on paper, right? Like, I think a lot of folks look at the Flash as like, oh, it's just the comedic relief and so on and so forth. But no, it's like that comedy is born out of like, you know, the trauma and the loneliness and like the needing friends. And so like, it just felt so organic, and it felt like I recognized a lot of the world I see, you know, on the day to day within that. I mean, the Themyscira stuff was just like, it was pretty mind blowing. I think what's weird is like, the way in which Zach sort of treats these characters, right? Like, I think he has a very deep sense of respect for the characters that he's working on. And it doesn't matter like what the sex, the gender, the, you know, the race of the character is. It's like, how can we elevate this so these folks can stand toe to toe? And it's like the Amazons, man, they were fierce. Like, and I remember talking to Chris Terrio after watching the movie, and I told him, I was like, you know, I was legitimately afraid for the kids in the museum when Wonder Woman is, when we see Wonder Woman for the first time, right? And I think the rated R aspect of the film, right? You see these folks walking into the museum, and you see there's an actual threat of violence. You see people being shot. You see like, okay, these guys aren't messing around. It just added a certain level of like, oof, a certain level of just like tension for me that I don't think was represented initially. All these, I mean, I can literally just talk about the whole film, and I don't want to spend 4 hours on have you guys time going through it like that. But those are some of my like favorite bits. Obviously the action, the end battle sequences, I mean, I don't think you can really beat it. It's pretty wild, and everything coming together with Junkie XL's music, like, yeah. One of the pieces that I thought was like really well done, and, you know, shout out to the editors on the film for, you know, making this happen, because I'm sure they had to watch hours and hours and hours and hours of footage, many, 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 many takes, is, you know, without having to comment on the idea of race, in that moment with Karen Bryson, when she's talking to the dean, and she corrects him about her title, you know, and he calls her Mrs. Stone, and she says Dr. Stone. And it's such a loaded moment. And the dean's response, you know, there's this look in his eye where, you know, you could see he kind of wants the challenger, but also can't. There's this like underlying layer of I don't really know how to describe it, sort of condescension, but also, it's layered without saying it. There's this layer of race when it comes to that. There's a layer of like status when it comes to that. It's, I mean, it's so much layered within just a single moment. And it's something that I think a lot of folks recognize, and watching people respond to that, not only just as a Black person, but also watching women respond to that moment, right? Of an individual asserting their power in a situation that that you in a situation that you need to is like, it's very interesting. So we can go, we can talk all day, but those are just some of the bits.
Well, one of the most talked about scenes from Justice League was your 15-minute origin story in Beloved Mother, Beloved Son. There was a moment where you helped a single mother and her child actually make ends meet. So how did you emotionally plug into Cyborg as a character to deliver on those moments? Because I really did feel, as a fan, that you really, like, those heartfelt moments were, like, amazing. That was when the Cyborg character was literally at his best.
Oh, well, thank you. For me, it's about the idea of, it's about holding on to the idea that things can and will get better, right, for the character. Ultimately, Victor Stone is a very, in certain ways, a very tragic character, right? Through no fault of his own, he has all these things befall him. And he's having to figure out how to get through his day-to-day life with those obstacles in the way, and finding joy, attempting to find joy in just the little things, like helping somebody out here, using your power for good there. I think, you know, because Victor has a good heart, right, which is what Eleanor says about him earlier in the montage. She says, you know, he helped Sarah because he has a good heart. You know, what did you do to help her? I think that tells you so much about the character without you even having to see the character. This is his mother speaking about him, right? He's willing to bend the rules just slightly if ultimately it's for a greater, if it's for the greater good. We're attempting to help somebody else. Is it the right thing to do? Is it completely the right thing to do? I mean, that's neither here nor there. The fact is that he's attempting to do something, right? And so for me, tapping into this idea of a sense of loss, right? There's a sense of, I would say to myself before we go into takes, like, you know, it's not fair. It's just not fair. And there's this innate sense within me about, you know, fairness that just like really resonates. And I think for that particular character, it probably, if you played back some of the audio as we were like gearing up, you know, rolling action, like right before that, I'm always muttering something to myself to sort of like get me in the zone, right? One of those things was, you know, it's not fair. 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 And it sort of puts me in a different in a different mindset. And that idea of fairness can take you one way. It could take you in a bunch of different directions, right? There's also the idea that Victor Stone, you know, he's a character, and this is from Marv Wolfman and George Perez's 1980s original version of Cyborg, where he wants to die. You know, he's upset with his father for essentially relegating him to a life in a condition that he does not desire to be to live in. And that's a really powerful thing. I think ultimately, you know, the idea of Victor helping, and I think the idea of Victor helping this single mother, right, is the idea, it's kind of like him also wanting to help himself in a certain way, right? You're sort of projecting the help that you want to receive onto other people. You know, I think, I don't know if you guys had seen recently, Leslie Jones had done a sort of like beat by beat run through of the film. And as Cyborg starting to learn his powers, you know, she had mentioned something along the lines of like, you know, good thing he's a good person. He started off as a good person. He's just hurt, right? Because if that power was in the hands of a bad person, like we'd be in trouble, right? And I'm sitting there like, okay, good, mission accomplished. She gets it, like people get it, you know? It's something that I think is universal, and the idea that you're helping a single mother, particularly in this time, right, in 2021, where, you know, you've got folks who are still waiting for stimulus check money. You know what I mean? You've got folks who really understand in a much different way what it's like to do without. Like it just, I think it hits differently, right? And that's what I think people really resonate toward is this idea that they've seen the trauma that he's endured and they're actually rooting for him to actually get better, right? That's something that it's an underdog story as well as one that's like a story of reconciling, right? Yeah.
And so it's funny because you speak about, you know, this kind of struggle that Cyborg is on, but in the end, he's a good person. But then, you know, the thing with Zach's films, you know, one of the themes is alienation of being the other. And after Cyborg helps this family, he smiles and he has this moment that he feels happy for like the first time, maybe since his accident. And then the right away, he turns around, he didn't put his hood up. And the first thing that happens is people are again he's feeling like a freak again. He's feeling again like the other. The second that momentary happiness came with helping someone, right away people are scared of him again. Then he puts the hood on again, going back, like basically kind of like a turtle going back into his shell. You know, like that hood was like the shell. So essentially, I mean, I know you're being humble about kind of everyone else's moments, but the way the general audience, even the critics have been responding to this movie, you were the lead. Like, you're the protagonist of this Justice League movie. And we've heard time and again about Cyborg's at the heart of the film, but actually seeing it play out was pretty eye-catching for the audience compared to what was given us in 2017. So take us in that creative process, because what led to, I mean, were you involved early where you were told that, listen, you're driving this thing? Like, yeah, Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman are in this, but this is your story. Like, how did that creative process come about in building this Cyborg character that now that the audience is seeing it are falling in love with?
Well, for me, I remember getting a call from Zach, and he had said, hey, listen, you know, you're in New York. Chris Terrio's in New York right at the time. And he's like, you know, you guys should get together and start talking about the project, right? And I ended up meeting with Chris. We ended up having a lunch, and we hit it off like right away, because Chris is a big theater guy. I'm a big theater guy. And so there were different, there was like a certain shorthand that we could refer to when talking about like the ideas for the piece. Like, we'd oftentimes like reference Shakespeare or reference, you know, plays that we both knew. But that particular process, and I've said it, I've gone on record to say it, you know, many times, I said, you know, if this is the only film, particularly in the DC side of things, that I'm blessed to do, I'm fine to have it be that, because, you know, to be able to work on something that is both meaningful and has consequence and can be inspirational, not just to adults and folks who, not just to adults, but also to kids, right? There are a lot of folks, younger folks, who have seen this, if their parents allowed them to watch it. and some friends' kids saying, oh yeah, I learned like everything about Cyborg that I needed to know to be on his side. And I think that's a testament to Chris and to Zach for wanting to elevate the character and for wanting me to be involved in some way or shape or form with just, you know, taking a look at pages as they were coming in. You know, you can tell they care very deeply about the characters. They care very deeply about storytelling, and they care very deeply about making sure that the representation of the character, both as someone who is differently abled or disabled, however, you know, whatever the appropriate term is, or that it was respectful to folks who were differently abled, but also people in the Black community. And so, you know, from what I understood, because I hadn't done much in the TV film space at that point, like, I understood that that was a luxury to be included just in that kind of discussion. And so, you know, it felt collaborative. I felt, definitely felt heard if there was ever anything where it's like, yeah, this could maybe be seen this way or that way. You know, we talk it out, and that would really be that, you know? Because there's always more than one way to do something, right? Like, ultimately, if it's like, hey, listen, we've got to do it this way, it's make or break, this is a really pivotal point of the film, you know, that may be a harder thing to come, that may be a harder thing to like get by on. But like, ultimately, if it's just like, hey, you know, I think this might indicate a different thing than what we may be intending, and if I were in the audience as a Black man watching this happen, it could come off this way. Not saying that it would, but it could, and it's just something to flag, you know. So it was a great process. I'd gone on record a while ago to say that I felt like maybe I've got a little spoiled by Hollywood terms when it came to like just being able to have a voice in the process. But it's one that I will never forget. It's one that I'm extremely grateful for. And, you know, clearly based on people's response to the film, it's a process that worked. So happy for it.
Some of the more scenes that you were in were the nightmare sequence scenes. What was it like coming back for additional shooting for those scenes? And were there any challenges in coming back amid the investigation?
Well, insofar as coming back goes, like, it felt awesome. I'm not going to lie. it felt really good. And there's something really nice about being able to finish the film with Zach, because, you know, the last bits that we had shot was reshoot stuff, right? So to be able to have my final memory of shooting this film be on set with Zach and some of the old crew, it almost, it kind of felt like coming home, you know what I mean? Insofar as doing it during the investigation, you know, I'm able to separate those issues where they need to be separated. Ultimately, the investigation was still going on at that time. And we were still sort of figuring out logistics as to how best to proceed with the investigation. But, you know, these are, they're involved, but also two separate issues, if that makes any sense.
It does. It does. And it's interesting because before we move on to the next section of this, I want to actually deep dive back into the film. And we talked about a lot of things like these big comic moments, but, you know, one of them comes where, you know, Cyborg kind of gets this premonition and you get a flash forward of what will happen in Justice League 2 or future Zach plans that he was thinking about. So, you know, and this is more to you as not just as an actor, but as a fan, when you're seeing this moment that Cyborg himself is plugging in, and when he gets out, he says the word no instead of go, and yeah. Superman still comes back. So like, just if you were thinking as how, what was Cyborg thinking? Like, does he still remember that he saw that the whole time? Like, is this something that is still part of him? Like, even when Superman's back and things are happening, or do you feel that the character kind of just like, okay, he saw it, but he didn't know what to think of it?
So I think the character, for me at least, I think that the character sees this thing happening and is trying to decipher, Victor Stone is trying to decipher what it all means. Because ultimately, you know, he believes the ship is showing him, you know, this thing, when in fact it could be a premonition, it could be the ship, you know, using some sort of tech to like try to predict as best it can, like the outcome of the action that's being done with Superman being brought back to life. And so for him, it's a very strange thing. And I think ultimately it had he, if he were more aware, because he doesn't know about, you know, Bruce Wayne's, he doesn't know about Bruce Wayne's premonition that he already had about the future, right? So for him to see this, I think it's more of a, oh, that was really odd. I'm not sure what to make of it. Let me not tell anybody because I don't want them to think I'm, you know, potentially like compromised, right? There's a lot going on in that moment. Insofar as like when we shot that in 2016, you know, Zach did lay out some of the stuff that, you know, Cyborg would be seeing. Like, you know, you see the world's destroyed, and you see Darkseid, and you see all these things happening. But I didn't get to see the full visualization of it until 2021. And so like when you see Darkseid underwater, you know, impaling Aquaman with the trident and the Omega beams that end up hitting, I'm assuming it's Vulko on that side, right? Like you've got, and it was wilder than I could have imagined even in that moment, right? Just crazy. So me as a fan, it's like, this is the kind of stuff that I fell in love with as a kid, is these kinds of stories, this kind of storytelling, meaning, consequence, action, heart, all of it. And like I said, like to be a part of it in this way, there's literally nothing better. Anything else for me is just sort of like a lateral move, right? I don't think you can get much better than this. I'm not a big like awards guy. I'm not a big like, hey, I need to win an Oscar. Like this is my personal achievement, my personal Oscar, if that makes any sense, you know?
I think a lot of fans would agree actually. And they have been agreeing, and now we have fans calling for restore the Snyderverse, something that's trending, and amid massive success for Justice League, do you feel sequels are still possible, and would you return as Cyborg? Is that something that interests you?
I think being able to don the mantle again, I absolutely would do it in a heartbeat, but obviously there are other circumstances that make that complicated and difficult. I don't know anything about any sequels being planned as it stands right now. I'm usually the one of the last people to know when this stuff happens. But, you know, if the circumstances are right, I would not be opposed to returning. It's just, you know, we've got real life going on and there are other things that need to be addressed before we dive into that. So
some of the most heartwarming reactions from Justice League came from people of color or differently abled people who felt a strong connection to Cyborg. Do you feel that this is like the true power and inspiration of this character?
I mean, I would agree with that wholeheartedly. You know, I've said before, like, you know, if this story is done correctly and a Cyborg is represented correctly, he can touch a lot of hearts for a lot of different reasons. And I mean, the overwhelmingly positive response to Cyborg in Zack Snyder's Justice League, I literally was not expecting I wasn't expecting it. You know, the 2017 version of the character, while folks, I think it did still resonate. I think the bones of what we had tried to maintain from Zach's version was still there in some way, shape, or form. But for folks to see themselves within this, right? For folks to send me tweets saying, you know, hey, I've got a cochlear implant, like I'm a cyborg, it resonates with me. For other folks with disabilities, they're like, you know, thank you for treating the character with respect, with dignity. You know, it makes a really big impact. You know, there's a lot of young folks as well, young people of color, who see themselves, who've been able to see a little bit more of their life through the lens of Cyborg, right? And this story for me as a Black man, growing up with an absent father in a single mother household, right? My grandmother and my mother essentially raised us. This story has always hit pretty close to home for me. And so making sure that particular lens is respected, right? That particular view of things is respected, I think was really, really big. And I know for me, if I were a kid watching this growing up how I grew up, I would probably be affected by Victor Stone's story. So, yeah, I'm proud. I couldn't be prouder.
You know, Ray, you mentioned, you know, how there's the real world and then there's, you know, the film and the fun of the film, right? But let's transition to the real world and let's cover some of the investigation process. I mean, the investigation came to a close in December officially, and the studio's statement at the time was that remedial action was taken. Yet since then, we have not heard much about what that action was or what the findings were in general. So in your opinion, why do you feel the studio has not fully disclosed the findings of the investigation or what steps were taken to create a safer studio culture?
Well, it's tough because myself and my team, we also have not been made aware specifically about what the remedial action is. And that's been one of the big pushes, is trying to get some actual information about what is being done and effectively like what the results of the investigation were. As a corporation, you know, I don't believe they legally have to share those details, but because things have been so public and because the corporation itself has been commenting and telling people what they didn't find or trying to convince people about what they didn't find, it seems a little strange that they're unwilling to comment on what they did find, right? You can go on my social media and see how it is that we've been going back and forth. I think anybody watching this, can scroll through and see that there is something going on. It's just a matter of getting folks to come to the table and actually talk about it. So insofar as what that impetus is for not relaying that information, I can only imagine it's to protect the company. But I've made it clear that I don't plan on going anywhere when it comes to attempting to get some real answers and some accountability. Whether or not that actually comes, you know, I don't know. But what I am thankful for is the public's support. You know, it's been a really long journey from July of last year to where we're at right now. And, you know, if it weren't for folks being able to read between the lines when it comes to certain articles that are being put out, when it comes to folks being able to piece together what it is that I've been able and willing to say publicly at this point, I think people understand now, especially with the film coming out, and they can see the different versions of the film. They can see that there's validity to the things that I've been saying, and hopefully, you know, we'll be able to press on how we need to go ahead and get some accountability. So, the struggle continues.
So, speaking of different articles, this week, Anne Sarnoff, the Warner Brothers CEO, was interviewed by Variety and said the investigator found the changes made during reshoots for Justice League were not racially motivated. This conflicts with your own statements on the matter. How would you respond?
Well, from what I understand, what I was made aware of from the investigator, Ann Sarnoff would not have been the person that would have received a readout of the findings of the investigation. I find that to be a little bit odd. Also, I think it's important for people to understand that the investigator hired by Warner Media is simply a lawyer that is hired to help the company assess and evade legal liabilities. So it wouldn't make much sense for an investigator to say, yeah, there's racism here. Let's talk about that publicly, because that would open up a whole can of worms for these folks legally and financially, potentially. So, I mean, it's the expected answer. It's one that clearly the public at this point, seeing the film, both versions of the film, just in having a basic knowledge of the things that have been alleged and what has come out, I think the public, you know, can make up their own minds. Ultimately, I think what the investigator is attempting to do is to let the company know what it is that folks who are alleging this stuff would be able to prove in court, or what they might be able to, whether or not they'd be able to win a case in court. And unfortunately, you know, this has evolved beyond that. It's evolved into a matter of this has evolved and gone into the sort of court of public opinion, right? Ultimately, to be able to prove racial animus when it comes to these sorts of things, unless you ask somebody directly, hey, what was the impetus for this? And have them go, oh yeah, I was being racist about it. That's the only way you could really lock that down, you know, which nobody in the right mind would ever say, right? But what we do know is that we have studio executives prior to the reshoot process having conversations saying we can't have an angry Black man at the center of the movie. And those individuals then proceeded to contribute to the reduction and removal of not just all the Black, of all the Black characters, but all the characters of color throughout the film. I mean, you've got to be trying hard not to find anything when you're looking at those facts. So I can understand why as an officer of the corporation, one would say, or want to promote the idea that there was never any racism at the company. But you also have to look at previous statements that were made by executives at Warner Brothers, where they acknowledge that there has been racism at the company, right? There are articles from last year where I believe it was Ann Sarnoff and Jason Kilar admitted that, you know, there's a race problem at Warner Brothers. And so, you know, I find it quite odd that there's an acknowledgement on one end, but not potentially on another. So, you know, we're still trucking right along, and I'm going to be doing whatever it is that I need to do, or whatever it is that I can do to get the facts and the truth out there. But I encourage people to stay patient, and for folks who have been supporting, I thank them for that. And for the folks watching the movie and seeing the difference and the disparities between the two, you can let them make up their own minds. I think the public is a lot smarter than, you know, these PR statements and these PR pushes from the corporation. So, you know, at the end of the day, if you can't win it in court, at least hopefully you can win it in the court of public opinion. So, you know, we'll just keep moving.
So from a public perception, you know, it seems like every time you tweet about the alleged abuse you and others faced, the studio responds with this sprawling statement within the same day. And it's pretty rare, like in general in Hollywood, in terms of how an actor in a studio would normally go back and forth. And this cycle has been going on for almost a full year now. So, you know, for you, Ray, what is the end game for you? And when do you feel like you've succeeded your goal?
Well, ultimately, you know, I've pushed for an apology for the false information that was put out about myself and the disparaging of the investigation that happened last year. I think the end goal, the end result, you know, it is my firm belief that the folks that have talked about Walter Hamada, Jeff Johns, John Berg, Toby Emmerich, Joss Whedon, because of their behavior, I do not believe that that they are fit for positions of leadership and should be in charge of the hiring and firing of other people. You know, I'm not about cancel culture. I'm not about any sort of like mass sort of shunning without the ability to resolve an issue. But these are things that we need to bring to light. And until we have some public and like really hard truth telling, unfortunately, most of this stuff gets swept under the rug. So, ultimately, I think if we can't get accountability, I think for me, the end game is simply making people as aware as I possibly can about who they may be coming into contact with. So that way they don't fall into the same sort of issues that I found myself in, and that some of the folks who worked on Justice League found themselves in. So if we can't get accountability, I want to try to raise awareness.
Yeah, Ray, and I think that the way audiences will be and the fans in general will be responding to this will be very interesting as it plays out. I mean, like we said, it's been now 1 year. So I think as each step goes forward, at the minimum, people are being more informed than they were before. I think that that's an interesting point to take out of it. But, you know, the next part, Ray, is going to be this kind of rapid fire out of the box questions, which aren't going to be too directly related to Justice League or even the investigation. But let's want to hear your thoughts. We did this with Zach earlier in the year. Wilmer, why don't you take that first rapid fire?
So if you could play any Marvel superhero, who would it be and why?
Iceman, because I think he's cool. No pun intended.
All right, that's not too bad. But John, what do you want the next one?
So if you could pick any director aside from Zack Snyder to direct a solo Cyborg film, who would you choose?
It would have to be Rick Famuyiwa. Yeah.
So Ray, you know, the rumor has it that you were a big fan of Yu-Gi-Oh! Growing up. So the easy question is, what is your favorite card and do you still play?
Freed the Matchless General was one of my favorites from the very early days. I mean, it's evolved now beyond like even my ability to comprehend the metagame. So I don't play as much, even though I've got my buddy Geets is trying to convince me every day to come back to the game. I think it's evolved beyond my, ability to like split my brain amongst strategies, but definitely Freed the Matchless General. And he's not even, what's funny is like, technically he's not even that great a card, right? Like on paper, it's just one that I was like, oh, I just feel like an affinity to it in some way, shape or form. So, yeah.
That's, well, you know, if you ever wanted to pick up the cards again, we'd be happy to face you because actually we grew up with that show.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're very, very much into it, Yu-Gi-Oh! Growing up, yeah.
You started a Twitch fairly recently. Has gaming always been a hobby of yours? And what are some of your favorites?
I've loved gaming since I was a kid. I used to sit around my brother, Tyrone, who's 10 years my senior. Like, he would play Super Nintendo and I'd be his, like, navigator. Like, oh, go over there. Go over here. Do this, do that. And, you know, I've loved video games probably before I loved anything else. If there's one thing I would ever give up acting for, it would probably be to just like play video games if possible. On the Twitch side of things, it's a bit more interesting because like I realized that I do love video games, but you know, I love them because it's something personal. I get to like decompress and be in my own zone. So it's a bit of a different thing trying to like, trying to entertain folks while playing, right? It's like wearing a bunch of different hats. Some of my favorite games are Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time, of course, Castlevania, Symphony of Darkness. I was a big fan of the Soul Reaver series, or Legacy of Kain series, rather. Sonic Adventure. I loved like everything on Dreamcast. I don't know whatever happened to Dreamcast, but you know, that's neither here nor there. Marvel versus Capcom fighting series or fighting franchise. What else? Ghost of Tsushima. My buddy Daisuke Tsuji is in that. And Daisuke is in that. Then what else? What else? What else? Go on literally all day. Super Smash Brothers, of course. Of course, how could it not? What else have I been playing recently? I've been playing the new Mario, the Bowser-oriented one. I forget the name of it, actually. But that's pretty fun. I've never been like the biggest Mario platformer like person, but I'm enjoying how I can just like tune out with it these days. So stop me whenever I get too far down the list because I know it's supposed to be rapid fire, but I'm like, what else? There's Divinity, Original Sin 2. That one's really cool. It's more like a strategy RPG, right? Sort of turn-based deal. Really involved. Didn't think I would like it as much as I do, but I'm patiently awaiting the next one of those. I think the guys that are doing that are doing Baldur's Gate 3. I have never played any Baldur's Gates, but hopefully these guys at Larian Studios will come back and do Divinity soon so we can get into that. But I'm not expecting it for another however many years.
Have you ever played Kingdom Hearts?
Yeah. I played Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2. I did not play Kingdom Hearts 3, but I enjoyed the series a lot. The first one in particular, with the Sephiroth battle at the end. That one was like a really beautiful mix of like new RPG and old nostalgia, right? Because the relationship that you have with the characters going into it, like, you know, Beast from Beauty and the Beast and everything else, like having it represented in ways that you don't normally associate, right? In a turn-based RPG is really cool. So
nice. I think that's pretty much the end of the rapid fire round. We're huge fans of Kingdom Hearts as well, so that's why I wanted to just see if you know, have you also been playing it or not? But
yeah, I haven't played any new one. Yeah.
And maybe we should set up a comic book debate Super Smash Bros. Tournament, you know, and
let me know.
Yeah,
I'm around, man. We can make it work. Yeah.
So, like you mentioned earlier, you're working on the ABC limited series "Women of the Movement," a series that centers around and on the killing of Emmett Till. Why do you feel this is the right time to tackle a series, to tackle stories like this? And what can you share about your role?
Well, I think the story is necessary. It's tragic, but also beautiful because it's not just about the tragedy of Emmett Till, but about how his mother, Mamie Till Mobley, essentially starts off the civil rights movement, right? Her finding her voice, becoming an activist, and she remained an activist until, you know, the day she died. You know, it's a really powerful story of overcoming, you know, in spite of a tragedy. And I think the folks who are in charge of this, because it's actually an anthology series, right? I believe each season is going to focus on a different influential Black woman in the civil rights movement. So Mamie Till Mobley is just the first. But I think it's necessary. I think the folks who are telling these stories are absolutely the right people to tell them, right? We've got Marissa Jo Sarar, our showrunner, Gina Parents Bythewood, directed the pilot, you know, Tina Mabry, Julie Dash, and Casey Lemons are all directing episodes as well. And it's been pretty revelatory for me because I realized that I'd never worked with a Black director in TV film, you know, in my career yet. And I've never worked with a female director in TV film. So to be able to work with both and multiple at that, right? It's been a really, really, really just a beautiful thing. And, you know, as I always say, like the environment of the set trickles down from the top, and the same, you know, love and care that you feel that I felt with Zach and Chris, I definitely feel that, you know, here on this production as well. So, and for me, telling this story at this time, both, I think it's a perfect blend of what it is I need personally and what it is I need professionally, because where we're at in the world and what the personal struggle has been with everything related to the Justice League investigation, I mean, there's no other sort of story that I think I should be telling or should be a part of right now, besides one that is going to help inspire folks to continue to fight for justice when it comes to matters of race. So I play a character named Gene Mobley, and he would have been Emmett Till's stepfather eventually if Emmett Till had lived. But, you know, he's an extremely supportive individual of Mamie and of her journey. And, you know, I can't wait for you to see this piece because it's going to be beautiful. It's going to be heart-wrenching. It's going to be infuriating. It's going to be a lot of things. But it's going to be powerful, and I think it's going to be uplifting in certain ways as well. So,
well said. And I think at the minimum, after Justice League, I mean, the fan base around you has grown pretty exponentially, and you've had there's so many new faces, so many new people who are discovering you, and it's not just like new actors or new directors and new producers are discovering you. It's new fans, it's new general people who just clicked on HBO Max and they fell in love with your character. So you're getting this influx of new supporters kind of who are actually seeing your journey also in real life and the things that you're kind of battling against. So if for the last question, I would say, if you had to say something to your new fans or to your existing fans of how best to support you, what would you say?
Support me because of who I am. What I would encourage people to do is support folks who may be encountering issues in the workplace, right? Ultimately, you know, I've never liked people being mistreated at the jobs. I've never stood for it, even at my day jobs prior to entering Hollywood. And, you know, I don't support and won't condone that stuff now that I'm sort of in the Hollywood mix. So if you want to keep supporting me, I'd say if we can keep supporting accountability, that's the best way to do it.
Well said. Ray, God, thank you for joining myself and my brothers today. We really appreciate you sitting with us, and definitely congratulations on the success of Zack Snyder's Justice League. I mean, I'm saying this as a journalist and even as a critic who's been watching the overall, keeping a pulse on how people are feeling about this movie. And I'm not exaggerating when I say you are the bona fide star of this movie. So congratulations for that.
Thank you. And thank you, Faruqi Bros, for having me. I hope this will not be the last time we get to chat about this kind of stuff. And thank you to you all out there watching.
Great. So from myself, from Zayan, from Umar, from Samir, and from our guest today, Ray Fisher, we're the Faruqi Brothers, and we'll see you next time. Peace out.